The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, the 10th of March, 2006, and this is show number 46. I am your host, Bob Hayes. Thank you very much for downloading the show. Okay, we've got yet another Gigantor show today. Loads of good stuff to talk about. There's a few news items that I want to pass on about MotoGP, World Superbike, and AMA. Then we're going to do a real quick and hasty Barcelona IRTA test report, followed by a review of Valentino Rossi's autobiographical book, What If I Had Never Tried It? That's recorded by Jules Cheesick, a.k.a. Pop Monkey from RideOn2.com. I thought the opportunity to have a review of Rossi's book included in show number 46 was too good to pass up, and Jules was good enough to kind of make sure he got that done in time for this show, so we're going to present that. After that, we've got a way cool interview with Reese White and Andrew Leisner of none other than Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. Reese and Andy spent some time on the phone with me talking about the improvements that are happening at Laguna Seca and the plans that are being put in place for this year's Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix in July. So it was a very interesting conversation. I think you'll enjoy it. But first of all, I want to give a shout out to Tom in Harefield, England. Tom is an 8-year-old petrol head and MotoGP fan that listens to MotoGPOD with his dad, Ed, every week. Now, Tom is the youngest listener that I know of so far, and that's pretty cool. It's not every day that you run across serious MotoGP fans that are Tom's age. They're, you know, kind of usually more concerned with cartoons and stuff. So, hi, Tom. Thank you very much for listening. Next, as many of you will have noticed, I ran a special episode earlier this week. It was a roundtable discussion from Michelle Dove. Now, Michelle is another regular contributor to RideOn2.com, and she's been thinking about doing a podcast, and because there's a certain level of cooperation between MotoGPOD and RideOn2, we worked out an arrangement to include Michelle's show in the regular MotoGPOD feed. Now, Michelle's format was a big change from the usual MotoGPOD format, but, you know, there's room for that in the world of motorcycle racing podcasts. I've said it before, and I'll probably say it again. I kind of do the NPR-style format for the show, and it's really not for everyone. I can't tell you how many emails and blog posts and forum threads that I've read that say, you know, that I need a second voice on the show or that I'm not excited enough or whatever. And I don't let any of that bother me. I do the show the way I like to do it, and I let it go from there. I'm leaving it, you know, up to other people to do the different styles of radio show things sort of thing. Now, some of you liked Michelle's format, and some of you didn't. You know, that's to be expected. Just like this format, it's good for some people, but not for others. But universally, the big problem with the episode was the audio quality. It just wasn't that great. And that's my fault for including it. I really should have asked Michelle to re-record it before I included it in the feed. But when I listened to it with headphones, I was in a fairly quiet room and I had one hand right in the volume control and it was livable. But many of you thought that it kind of wasn't livable, and after I listened to it again, I guess I sort of have to agree. So I want to apologize to all of you out there that thought the quality was really bad of the sound, and also apologize to Michelle for not voicing my concerns about that quality and really twisting her arm to re-record it. She knew it'd be difficult to recapture that sort of free-for-all effect that she had going on, and that was what she was really going for, so it was kind of a one-take sort of a thing. Michelle and I have talked about the overall reaction to the show, and basically we've agreed that including her show in the regular MotoGPOD feed probably won't work. She might very well do more shows of her own, and when she does, I'll be sure to tell you how to find them. But, you know, it will be a different podcast with a different feed and not sort of under the same MotoGPOD feed. And I really kind of actually hope she does do some more shows. There's still a lot of room in the motorcycle racing podcast pool, and the water here is just fine. So thanks to all of you out there that send in your feedback. I appreciate it, as always. I will say that I did get a little more than normal email in the MotoGPOD at MotoGPOD.com mailbox this week, but that's cool. You know, I tried to answer them all. And one more thing about other podcasts and the like. If you're a subscriber to Ray Duvall's Knee Dragon podcast, you need to know that he had some technical problems with his feed last week, and you might be, like, orphaned in iTunes or whatever program that you use to subscribe. All you need to do is resubscribe in the iTunes podcast directory or go to the official Knee Dragon site at kneedragon.libsyn.com and just resubscribe from there. And, of course, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. All right, now that that's all out of the way, let's move on. All right, like I said, lots of stuff happening in the world of motorcycle racing this past week. One very obvious event was the second round of the World Superbike racing season last weekend. Superbikes were at Phillip Island in Australia. Now, I'm not going to do a whole race report on it, but let me tell you, if you haven't seen those races, you missed a couple of really, really good ones. Superbike is off to a huge start. It's going to be a really fantastic season. A lot of really good racing was going on there at Phillip Island last weekend. Now, one small thing that I noticed on the Superbike broadcast, on the new graphics that they're using when they do the pre-race show and they display the circuit map and the temperatures and all that business, they misspelled circuit length. They got it L-E-N-G-H-T. Then it was that same way for the guitar round and at Phillip Island. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, we'll see if anybody from World Soup is listening and if they fixed that in time for the next race at Valencia, which is the 21st through the 23rd of April. Another item, Italian website MotoOnline.com had an interview with Rossi after day two of the Barcelona tests. MotoGPOD listener Francesco Ardia helped me out by translating the article, and among the usual talk of improvements to the bike and other chit-chat, MotoOnline mentioned that Rossi doesn't seem to have any rivals anymore. They went on to say, "You used to speak of Melandri and Pedrosa. What about now? And Hayden?" Rossi replied, "Hayden doesn't seem to be as strong as them. Maybe I'm wrong, but Pedrosa and Melandri have more talent. They can conduct a race with reasoning, whilst usually Nicky manages to follow but never really to attack." Now, that's interesting. I don't recall Rossi talking smack about Hayden before. It may well be very true, but I think that at the end of last season, it sure looked like the only guys that were likely to challenge Rossi much were Hayden and Melandri. Now, Pedrosa is something of an unknown, being new to the MotoGP series this year, but I think that we can count on Melandri and Hayden bringing that fight to Rossi, and we'll just have to see whether it's true or not. In the world of MotoGP politics, and we're talking real politics, that is, you know, not silly season silliness, Tech 3 team director Hervé Poncharal took over as president of the International Race Teams Association. Cito Pons, who's been president for as long as anyone can remember, pretty much, took his name off the ballot not too long ago. But we haven't seen the last of Cito Pons. He was spotted in pit lane in the Barcelona test. He was going to all the garages and visiting, wearing a nice suit, and drove up in a Porsche Boxster. So Cito's going to be back. We'll see him sooner or later. He's apparently still got employees on the payroll. He's keeping his team, well, not completely alive. It's not dead. So, you know, he'll be back. And in other news, the Kawasaki Eckel MotoGP team's race transporter truck had a fairly serious accident last Monday on the trip from Barcelona to Jerez for the next round of tests. Apparently, high winds caused the truck to crash by forcing it off the road onto the shoulders so that it then tipped over. Mechanics Jason Corney and Josef Buchner were in the cab, and both were injured, unfortunately. Jason lost the little toe on his right foot, ouch, and had to get surgery for the rest of his toes, while Josef dislocated his shoulder. Thankfully, neither mechanic was more seriously injured than that. And then all four of the team's race bikes were in that trailer during the crash, but they packed those things pretty well in those shipping cases that they use, so they were miraculously not seriously damaged, and the team is planning on still testing at Jerez. Now, and in AMA's news, the quote of the week definitely goes to Matt Mladen. During the Daytona Superbike qualifying session press conference, Mladen was asked if he thinks that launch control exists in World Superbike, you know, after what we've seen in the past couple of weeks here with World Superbike racing. Mladen replied, "I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't really watch it. I don't follow it too much, especially now after they all got the shits when I smoked them at Phillip Island." So there's old Matt, always doing his best to make friends and put a good face on everything. The MotoGP teams all showed up last weekend, March 3rd through the 5th, for the first genuine official real-live IRTA test of the year at the Circuit de Catalunya in Barcelona, Spain. Now on Friday, day one, Valentino Rossi showed up at the circuit just about lunchtime, which is seems to be kind of a pattern lately, but that didn't stop him from going out and setting a fast lap pretty much right away. Later in the session, he crashed, and then he decided to end his testing for the day around 3:30. However, his fast lap stood as the fastest of the day, the only lap in the 143s on that first day of the test. So, for day one, we had Rossi with the fastest lap, followed by Colin Edwards. Third was the very surprising Spaniard Carlos Checa, who is just shocking me, with his performances in these tests. He took the third fastest lap of the day. So, top three fastest times on Friday were all Yamahas, one of them even on Dunlop tires. Now, that's interesting. We also got to see the new livery for the Tech 3 Yamaha. They went with yellow and black, but it kind of looks a lot cooler than the camel yellow. It looks a little more aggressive, yellow and black. They didn't go with that over-the-top sort of retro look or anything like that. And the lack of all those sponsor logos on the bikes give it a nice, clean appearance. Fourth fastest on day one was John Hopkins. Now, where are the Hondas, you might ask? Well, Nicky Hayden had fifth fastest on his Honda, but then in sixth, we have a Kawasaki, ridden by Shinya Nakano.
Seventh,
Sete Gibernau on a Ducati. Eighth, Marco Melandri, finally another Honda. Ninth, Tony Elias, and tenth, Makoto Tomita. So in the top 10, we have four Hondas, but the best Honda time is only fifth fastest. And out of the top seven fastest times, we have five different manufacturers represented. So we're really seeing a great mix this year of the times and the level of competition stepping up, and the motorcycles are all, I think, maybe evening out a little bit. At least that's how it looks with the testing. You know, obviously we're going to see what happens on race day, but so far with the tests that we've seen this year, it's really shaping up to be a great mix for the season. Day one continued with Kenny Roberts Jr. in 11th, then Danny Pedrosa in 12th. Now, Pedrosa admits that he's going to be having to work on his physical strength in order to get the most out of his RC211V. And, you know, Danny, you've got less than 3 weeks, so you might want to be thinking that it's time for some protein shakes or something. Kind of get going on that, because you don't have a whole lot of time to be doing the physical training thing now. Randy DePunier was 13th, Loris Caparossi 14th, Chris Vermeulen 15th on his Suzuki, James Ellison not last in 16th on his Yamaha, followed by Jose Luis Cardoso in 17th on one of the Dantin Ducatis. 18th and bottom of the list for MotoGP regulars was Alex Hoffman. Now, two test riders took the 19th and 20th spots. It was Tadayuki Okada riding a Honda for HRC in 19th and Vittoriano Guareschi on a factory Ducati in 20th. Casey Stoner did not ride. He's still recovering from that shoulder injury and will apparently not ride until the opening round at Jerez on March 26th. And you may have noticed, no WCM. So we're still not sure if we've kind of driven the nail in that coffin or not. I'm not sure if I just missed any sort of official announcement about that or what. There are rumors. A few sites have it saying, you know, that WCM is gone, but there has been no official WCM is gone press releases or announcements that I've seen. Day two, the weather was gray, but, you know, it was gray looking, but it was dry. Going real quick down the list, Rossi took the top spot again, second day in a row. He ran a 142.48, the only rider to break into the 142s. Then Checa in second, surprisingly, doing very well again still. Actually, not surprisingly, he just continues to do well. Nakano again putting in a great performance to get third. Then Edwards in fourth, almost a full second off Rossi's time, whereas on day one he was only about 4/10 back of Rossi. Both riders have supposedly sorted out their problems with chatter, so we should be hearing less about that. Fifth fastest, Gibernau, then DePunier. Wow, DePunier in six. You know, go Randy. Good job. Seventh fastest, John Hopkins. Okay, now I've gone through the top seven positions. And have you noticed what manufacturer has not yet had a rider in the top seven? And yep, you got it. It's Honda. Curiouser and curiouser. We just not seeing the Hondas in the top spots lately. Well, Hayden had the eighth fastest time. Tomata 9th, Pedrosa 10th, who, by the way, had a crash on day 2. Then KRJR on the Honda-powered Team KR machine in 11th, which, speaking of Team KR, they used a new third version of their 2006 chassis on day 1 of the testing, but then they went back to an updated second version on day 2. So they're kind of still hammering out that whole issue and deciding exactly which way they're going to go with the chassis. But they are doing really well, and it's nice to see them in the upper numbers. And Junior was only 4/10 off of fast Honda rider Hayden, so that's really kind of something. Next, at 12th fastest, was Marco Melandri. So, there's a whole bunch of the Hondas bringing up the middle of the pack. So, you know, I really don't know what exactly is going on here. Are these Hondas sandbagging? I don't think so. For starters, it's still only Hayden that's out there on the 2006 spec bike. All the other guys are riding 2005s with, you know, some new bits here and there. And even though this is still a test, not an actual race, the stakes are getting bigger and bigger all the time. The teams and the riders really do want to do well in these things. They don't necessarily always want a sandbag. I mean, otherwise, why are we seeing Rossi going for these fast times? Especially the newer guys, you know, and these guys really do have something to prove at this track and at any other. You know, they want fast times to send a message to everyone else, but it's pretty hard to intimidate the other guy when you suck. So it's not happening, and I'm wondering what's going to happen here come race day, or at least come next test at Jerez. So 13th fastest on day two, continuing on our thing, Caparossi. Not exactly having the best weekend, Loris wasn't. He was sick with some kind of nasty stomach thing. He only did 15 laps there on day two. The Clinica Mobile docs actually advised him not to ride at all, but Loris is a stud, and he went out there for a while anyway. And now that is sending a message. You know, I might be sick as hell, but I'll show up on race day. So, you know, good old Loris. Vermeulen was 14th. Ellison 15th, moving up a spot. But still 2.3 seconds off of teammate Cheka. Coming to grips with a bike still, maybe something like that. At least, let's hope that's what it is. 16th, Cardoso. Then Elias, who had a terrible day. Couldn't get the necessary rear grip, apparently. 18th, Hoffman. And test rider Guareschi bringing up the rear in 19th. Okada did not ride on day two. Okay, on to day three, the big day of the test. We're going to zip through this. This was the day where the fast lap rider of the afternoon's, you know, special one-hour session gets a shiny new BMW Z4. Unfortunately, the weather was awful. Lots of rain. This, which really put a damper on things, so to speak. In that critical afternoon session, a lot of riders went down. Hopkins, Rossi, Roberts, Melandri, and Cheka all fell, and this, combined with the rain, upset the sort of more normal order of the universe. So, since the order of the universe is upset, we're going to do things here a little different, and we're going to invert the order for the lap times of that BMW M Award qualifying session. We're going to start at the bottom. So, in 19th position on the official scoreboard, Ducati test rider Vittoriano Guareschi. 18th position, Pedrosa, who simply did not do very many laps all day long, still getting used to the MotoGP bike, and has not yet completed a race simulation. He has not gone, you know, the 25 or 30-odd laps that he's going to need to do in a race. He's only done about 10 at a time. Sort of worry about endurance with Pedrosa. 17th, Cardoso. 16th was Gibernau, who also only did a very few laps. Then in 15th, Elias. 14th, Caparossi, probably still feeling under the weather. 13th was Hoffman, not last for a change. It's nice for him. 12th, Tomada. 11th, Nakano. 10th, Depunier. 9th, Hopkins, who managed to get his bike up and out on track again after his fall into the gravel. 8th place, Cheka. And then 7th went to Roberts, both of whom had fast laps that were spoiled by trips into the kitty litter of their own. 6th fastest of the day, Melandri. 5th fastest was Vermeulen, faster than his teammate. By the way, the two Suzukis posted the highest trap speeds of any of the bikes during that session in the afternoon there. 4th fastest lap of the session, James Ellison. So, all right, James. Woohoo. Getting up there. He was only one of the 4 riders to break the 2-minute mark, by the way. So we might look for James to do well in the rain. He actually had the fast lap for much of that session until about the last 15 minutes or so when the other guys started really pushing. So I think James is just going to be doing rain dances all season because apparently he's going to be pretty strong in the wet. And then in a less than usual 3rd place, Valentino Rossi. 2nd place coming up out of lap time exile on his very last lap was Nicky Hayden. And then the winner of the BMW Z4 for setting the fastest lap of the session with a time of 157.1, almost 2 seconds faster than runner-up Hayden, was Yamaha rider Colin Edwards. So, although the last session was wet, it was a very good test session overall, with the teams getting some valuable data, and what it tells us about the season is a little hard to say, so we're just going to have to wait and see. But this weekend, coming up, March 10th through 12th, the teams go to Jerez for the 2nd official test. Then it's a short break, and ready to start the season on March 26th.
Listen up, sport riders. If you're not listening to the D-Dragon Podcast, you're not getting the whole story. The D-Dragon Podcast has news, race results, new bikes, tech talk, riding technique, interviews, opinion, and of course, shameless self-promotion. So check us out, ddragon.net, or on the iTunes Music Store under Podcast. D-Dragon will find us, and then we'll find you.
Greetings, MotoGP OD listeners. This is Jules Cisek, Pop Monkey from RideOn2.com. A few weeks ago, I finished reading Rossi's autobiography, What If I Had Never Tried It, and decided to review it for you and the RideOn2 readers. So this book is pretty much an absolute must for anyone who loves motorcycle road racing. It's full of wit and surprising, sometimes even shocking, insights into the life of the world champion and the greatest motorcycle racer that I've ever seen. First off, you'll get the real scoop on all the infamous gags, from the bizarre story of Svaldo the chicken to the porty potty break. You'll finally get to read what Rossi has to say about the animosity with Biaggi, including what really happened with that elbow and incident at Suzuka and the staircase scuffle in Barcelona. You'll get to hear about Rossi's always fastest bike, at least the fastest according to the press, and of course his opposition. There's this really great story about Don Cesare, an 80-year-old Tavula priest who postpones service to watch Rossi race on the telly. You get a chapter on the Ferrari tests, an insight into Valet's superstitions, his battle with the downsides of success, and concerns about his privacy. I was pretty amazed reading about the madness Valet and his tribe engaged in on scooters and in ape cars, three-wheeled trucks that were never meant to be in demolition races on the winding roads of Italy. There's the memoirs of the two Suzuka 8-hour races Rossi participated in that are brutally frank and often hilarious. You'll even find out what Rossi was really doing inside his helmet at the end of Velcom 2004 GP. That was his first win with Yamaha. If you're a fan of Valentino Rossi, you won't be disappointed. The book has plenty of his opinions and sheds light on almost everything you've ever wondered about. But unfortunately, there's a downside. This book doesn't have enough to say about actual on-track motorcycle racing. Yeah, there are some great descriptions of the NSR 500's brutality, the training and riding sideways in the rock quarry with Graziano, and the short anecdotes from various races, but I really was hoping for more. But then again, this is a book that was written for fans and not racers, so I can't say I truly fault it. I mean, I didn't expect a twist of the wrist, but I do wish there was more about specific races, Valley strategies, the other riders, especially Gibernau, and so on. I also found some of the chapters tiresome. Valley's chance to break silence is sometimes just a personal attack back at the people who have annoyed him over the years, especially the Italian press. And the book also suffers somewhat from the ghostwriter effect and the Italian to English translation as well. But all in all, it delivers a great read, and there are three aspects of the story that were not only enlightening but downright beautiful, and I want to talk about them. The first, which is pretty much the beginning third of the book, describes the move from Honda to Yamaha. It is an amazing, revealing text that I read nearly breathlessly. All the secret meetings right under the nose of Honda, in the paddock during GP weekends at night. I was floored by this and how Valley dealt with the pressure of racing and the mornings after putting his career on the line. His reasons for leaving Honda and choosing Yamaha are very well stated, as is the third option he was considering. In a word, incredible. My high regard for this young man has gone up by leaps and bounds based on what I read here. Just imagine yourself at 24 years old, faced with those decisions and that pressure. Truly, this is a one-of-a-kind story that wiped away almost all of what I thought really transpired. The second aspect of the book that I really liked is Rossi's warm descriptions of his relationship with Jeremy Burgess and the latter's unique approaches. There's a lot of surprise about the young Rossi understanding that the team is key and always pursuing very specific people to work with instead of just looking for the best contracts. And he did this even like in 125s and 250s. I loved reading about Burgess especially though, because I feel he's almost as amazing persona in MotoGP as Rossi himself. He's super cool. Finally, there's Rossi's love affair with the motorcycle that connects him with all true lovers of motorcycling. His late nights spent alone with the bikes in the garage, sitting on the bike and just enjoying it in silence and meditation. His ability to communicate and motivate his team by talking about his bike, never treating it as a tool, but as an extension and always, always personal. And did you know that he actually applies practically all of the bike stickers? Crazy. Anyway, it is this love affair with his bikes that connects him to us. I, too, have spent many nights in my garage just staring at my bikes. I understand the lust. I imagine all of you do, too. Feeling the power hidden behind the sleek lines, that oneness with your mount, longing for the track or open road or for the speed. It is a wonderful thing to see that even a career racer with so much success, even then, this love affair is not lost. So this the book really delivers and was nearly impossible to put down. I've never been much of a biography reader, but I recommend this book completely, whether you are a Rossi fan or not. And by the way, you don't have to wait for the book to be released in your country. Thanks to the magic of the internet, you can just go to amazon.co.uk and buy a copy. The only difference I found was that my copy was dispatched instead of being shipped. So thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the book as much as I did. And now, I've always wanted to say this. Back to you, Bob.
Okay, thank you, Jules. That was great. I'm personally about halfway through the book myself. I'm trying to savor it, kind of make it last. It's very good reading. If you, listeners, would like to read Pop Monkey's actual written review of the book, he's got it posted up on rideon2.com. It's in a blog post called What If I Had Never Tried It, a book review. And I, of course, will put a link to that on the MotoGPOD.com website. All right. I have Reese White and Andrew Leisner from Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca's Public Relations Department here on the phone with me today. Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Hi, Bob.
We're going to talk a little bit about some of the improvements that are happening to the track this year and the upcoming Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix that's coming up here in July and all sorts of news that's been happening lately down there with the raceway. So, first of all, why don't we talk a little bit about those improvements on the track and the facilities? Kind of give us a real quick brief overview of exactly what is happening.
We've got quite a bit of construction underway here right now. These are all further changes needed to for our FIM homologation to retain the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix here at Monster Raceway Laguna Seca. Right now, the biggest project is Turn 1. We are removing the hillside on the outside of Turn 1, and that unfortunately meant that the old media center that many are familiar with atop that hillside had to be removed. That's been done. The hillside's been carved back, and a new building is being built on top of Turn 1 that will become a hospitality-specific building. It'll be the Red Bull Energy Center, thanks to Red Bull and their generous support of this event. In addition, we're gonna add a little more runoff room in Turn 3, also Turn 6. The chute between Turn 4 and Turn 5, which is normally a straightaway for most motorcycles and cars, but anybody who was here saw the MotoGP bike spinning their tire all the way through that little kink between 4 and 5. So we're going to give them a little more runoff room there. And the road up to the corkscrew through Turn 7, that too will be widened as well. The only change to the track surface itself, aside from a complete repave, will be the elimination or smoothing out of the little hump that the riders would crest on their way up to the corkscrew. It's a little bump where a lot of the MotoGP bikes data acquisition had them actually leaving the ground at that point in time. So they weren't too thrilled with that and asked that be shaved out when we did the repave. So that'll be done as well.
All righty. I was just going to actually ask about that turn or that little hump leading into the corkscrew there because, yeah, I know that getting air on a MotoGP bike is probably not the funnest thing. Now, are any of these changes going to be sort of drastically altering the nature of the course other than perhaps that bump right before the corkscrew?
Nope, that's it. That's it. You know, there was a lot of talk about removing the what we call the hump in turn one there, the rise in turn one. And Wayne Rainey, who's a great friend of ours and a great supporter of our track, was adamant about keeping that. Wayne feels that's the corner that really separates the men from the boys there. And as a result, it adds a lot of character to the track. It's really hard to get through. You're in top gear, and you're getting real light and feathering the throttle through there. So we kept that. So the nature of the track is really not going to change except for that little hump on the way up to the corkscrew.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, we had heard, you know, unbelievable as it may seem, we'd heard some rumors apparently that the corkscrew was somehow going to be eliminated. Did you ever, was that ever discussed seriously as an option? Is that something that, or was that just a vicious rumor?
I think that was just a rumor because there's too much history in the corkscrew. I don't think that corner's ever gone away. That's for sure.
I certainly hope not. I agree. I heard that from somebody said that they'd heard it was that rumor, and I was like, no way. And now, all right, it was no big secret that last year, you know, quite a few riders weren't overly thrilled with the circuit and they felt that their safety was on the line. Were these changes primarily driven by the MotoGP Rider Safety Group?
Yeah, it was driven by the MotoGP Rider Safety Commission. They felt that the track was a little too dangerous. And, you know, ironically, this is probably the safest racetrack for motorcycle racing in the United States. But still, the new MotoGP spec circuits being built all over the world right now have endless runoff, it seems like. The problem with that though is they're so much featureless, and we're really a true road course facility. We've got elevation changes, we've got blind corners, we have a lot of things that you don't see in these new, you know, mega million-dollar facilities that are popping up in across Europe and Asia. So they wanted some more runoff, and we're giving it to them. But again, we're not gonna take away some of the more exciting elements of this track. It's got a lot of history here. We're in our 50th year of racing, and it's one of the most exciting tracks in the world. And we're not gonna let that go away.
All righty. Now, is anything being changed as far as sort of fan facilities? Are the grandstands going to be covered? Are the grandstands going to be expanded or shrunken or anything like that?
Yeah, there are a couple things that were on our list to improve for this year, and those are improving the traffic situation, which we're working on right now, improving fans' ability to move around the facility, and improving the ability for fans to get food and drinks, souvenirs and restrooms and such. So those are big priorities of ours, and we're tackling them all right now. The most comprehensive one is our traffic plan. But yes, we are making some improvements to allow the fans to move around the facility a little better, a little easier. We had grand plans for new bridges and ways to get the fans across the track a little quicker, but unfortunately that money is being eaten up right now by some of these track changes. And as a result, this year we'll deal with our existing bridges, although Dorna has been gracious enough to discuss with us the possibility of track crossings when there are breaks in the program that will actually allow people to cross the racing circuit itself to alleviate some of the traffic congestion problems we saw on bridges last year.
Okay, yeah, that would be a big help. And there were some issues with specifically like footbridge traffic when celebrities were coming across and things like that that I know made some fans a little irate. And I understand that it's very difficult to get around that. There's almost no way short of all the celebrities coming in on maybe helicopters. But is something like that going to be addressed also next year?
Yeah, it's something that caught us a bit off guard. A lot of things caught us off guard last year, but that was one of them, and that was the absolute hysteria that surrounded one particular celebrity that was in attendance, and the difficulty in actually moving him from one place to another, and we have a complete celebrity sort of plan coming in place here. We have a lot of people interested, high-profile people interested in attending this event again next year, which is great, and we love them. We love them to attend, but we're going to try to minimize the impact that their presence has on our fans and our good customers here, and that's a plan we have in progress right now to, again, move them around the facility without inconveniencing anybody else.
Okay. And when you talk about the vehicle traffic plan, how are you going about improving that? I assume you're working with the local police jurisdictions to do something like that, but what would that entail exactly?
Well, it's not completely 100% finally approved here. We have sign-off on the majority of the government agencies, municipalities, police departments that all are part of this. And we're just about ready. I'd say we're just a couple weeks away from announcing this. But essentially, what we're trying to do is the majority of general admission automobile parking will take place off-site. That's our hope and our goal, and we will bus those people in on shuttle buses on a road that's dedicated solely to those shuttle buses. This is done at the PGA Golf Tournament here, the AT&T, that takes place at Pebble Beach here, and we're going to sort of take a page out of their book. It works extremely well. We're going to take a page out of their book and try to do that with again, sort of general admission car parking. In addition, we're going to dedicate a single road to motorcycles only. So no cars will be allowed on this road. It's motorcycles only, and these motorcycles will all park in our Wolf Hill or a couple different lots, but the majority of them will go in our Wolf Hill parking, which is just above the Scramp administrative offices here and the Turn 1 area. So finally, we'll have, of the four roads that enter this facility, another one will take private shuttles and Monterey Salinas Transit buses, and the final entrance will be dedicated to teams, media, track personnel. We hope with that plan, we'll eliminate a lot of the multi-hour waits people had getting in and out of the facility last year.
Okay, excellent. And now on that also, and I regret to admit that my sort of mental map of the entire facility is a little foggy. So I was camping there last year down in the lovely Archery campground, and the buses coming up from the camping area were getting stuck in traffic. Now, is this traffic that we're talking about, you know, being alleviated because of the parking being offsite and so forth, is that the traffic that we were stuck in? Are we going to see these buses coming up from the camping area in a more timely fashion?
Yes. Yeah, the problem there was on the road that sort of encircles our facility. It just became complete gridlock because different people coming in different entrances that had to go to different locations around the facility. We sort of strategically picked the roads that these different groups will enter on so that they won't have to travel around the circumference of the facility, and the road that they happen to enter in on will be right where either their shuttle bus drops them off or where they park their motorcycle or where they drive to go get into the team parking and such. We're going to try to keep that road as clear as possible so we can avoid that gridlock. That gridlock was one of the big problems with our concession stands in that, you know, if someone ran out of ice or someone ran out of product, they radioed our warehouse. Unfortunately, the warehouse would put a golf cart on the road with that product, and it would just be stuck in that gridlock that surrounded the facility. So we're planning on eliminating, not necessarily eliminating that, but minimizing that. And those buses coming up the hill on B Road, where you were, will be one of the beneficiaries of that.
And, I'm always a big fan of fixing the problem, not the blame, and definitely seems like you're fixing the problem. But last year, what sort of caused some of these breakdowns? Was there just a lot more people than you had anticipated, or?
Well, you know, we had the biggest crowd ever this facility has ever seen. And, people say Valentino Rossi is bigger than the Pope. Well, we proved it here because the biggest crowd we've ever had here was 1987. We had the Pope here in 1987 at the facility. That was the biggest crowd ever at the Laguna Seca Recreation Area. And then this year at Monterey Bay Laguna Seca, we beat that number with MotoGP. So that was pretty neat, and it caught a lot of people off guard. We've had some very big races here in the past with in the old IndyCar days and the old kart days, but this was a third again as big as those. So it was a lot of the people here on site, you know, had seen some big races and thought that this was going to be no bigger, even though the numbers we had were large. No one dreamed of what that many people in the facility would actually look like or feel like. So we got caught off guard, you know, plain and simple. But we're not going to get caught off guard next year. That's for sure.
Awesome. Fixing the problem. And then on to the whole event as a whole. With the decision to not have the 250s and the 125s, first of all, is that ever likely to change in the future years? And second of all, what sort of drove that decision?
Well, that's basically a Dorna decision as well. We had input on that as well. And you know, I come from a 250 GP background, so I would love to see them here, obviously. Unfortunately, though, the logistics and the costs of getting those other two classes here are just prohibitive for the event from Dorna's standpoint, from our standpoint. And in addition, our fan base, although we have a lot of diehard fans that would really love to see the smaller classes here, our fan base is asking, on the whole, more for that AMA Superbike program, which we give, which is a great racing, as we all know. Unfortunately, it's a little too difficult logistically and from a cost standpoint. And the majority of people here are really looking for the AMA Superbike stars to come out and show their stuff.
And Bob, I just want to jump. This is Reese. I just want to jump in for a second while you're talking to Andy. The other thing that I don't think the average person probably realizes, nor should they realize, is because we sit on a county park, we're only allowed to have 5 race events a year. We've got four auto races that are relatively established and continue to grow. By eliminating the AMA Superbike Series and have running 250s and 125s, just as an example, there wouldn't be a slot on our schedule that would allow us to have an AMA Superbike race. Unlike a lot of privately owned tracks, we can't just add another event. And I don't think we would want to, and I don't think our fans, given those options, would not want to see the AMA Superbikes here as a general group. So that's another part of that equation on top of the logistics and the costs that go along with that.
Understandable. And that's actually a perfect segue into my next question, which was that, you know, Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, and before that just simply Laguna Seca, you know, it's been in the same location for about 50 years, and yet it's now more or less semi-surrounded by homes that have been there for a much lesser amount of time, and these are the problems, I take it, that are driving the limit on the number of noisy events that you can have per year. Am I correct?
To a point, and certainly that prevents us not entirely prevents us, but does have a factor in what we can and can't do. But the our 5 event rule has long been established. It's been a number of years, and unfortunately, I don't have that exact number. But we've been sitting on 5 events for quite a while, and a lot of that is government red tape and how you can go about changing anything. We do sit on a county park and have to follow some government regulations, and when we want to do things, including our track changes this year, a lot of that has input from the Monterey County Parks, even though they may not be involved in a race operation standpoint. They're still very involved and have to be very involved in how we do things out here. And obviously, you know, they do take into consideration the residents around here, and as do we. And it's important to do. But you know, as you said, we're into our 50th season of racing, and there are a number of new houses around, though I don't know how much that really is driving that 5 event rule and the things that we can do.
Okay. So the typical internet chat room misconception, apparently it is a misconception that these, you know, to coin a phrase, whiny bags in these houses are losing us our race weekends. That's not true then. That's what you're saying, basically, right?
It makes for good internet chatter, though, doesn't it, Bob?
Yeah, it does.
The other thing, the other favorable situation there is everybody who buys a home in this area has to sign a document that says they understand that there is a race circuit here and that we do have 5 noisy events per year and that they you know, they agree to those terms. So we and again, you know, we're a county park and county owns this land, and you know, because of that, I see us being here for a long time.
Okay, yeah. And, I mean, I didn't know that about the document signing there. I think that's kind of interesting, actually. I personally would think that a house that's right next to Laguna Seca would be so much more desirable simply for that fact. But
yeah, for me. Anyway, if we could afford it.
Yeah.
If we could there.
I've heard also talk about some sort of, basically the quote was put to me, it was suggested question, we'd like to hear about buying noisy days, as if that there's a some sort of credits or money going to the people living nearby about the these noisy weekends. Is that another just complete off-base rumor, or is there anything to that one?
There's some basis there, maybe not in the quite in the way they have it phrased, but obviously, Monster Raceway Laguna Seca is rented nearly every day. I think Christmas was the single exception this year that we didn't have a track rental, including Thanksgiving and New Year's Day. And there is a bit of a, and I apologize again, I don't know the exact details, but there is a bit of a structure system in terms of how loud the noise meter can read on that particular day. Just to give you an example, on an SCCA regional or national weekend, the morning and afternoon sessions, they have to run the stock cars. And when I say stock cars, I mean actual stock cars, not NASCAR stock cars. The showroom stock classes in the mornings and evenings, because they're allowed more noise in the middle of the day when the sound travels less than they are at 8 in the morning or at 5 in the afternoon, for example. And there are different days that are structured through that. Now, that filters through Skip Barber, who runs their driving school out here, some of our sponsors that have more established days, a lot of team testing for different race series happen on the louder days. So we do have a number of days that allow more sound than others, but by the time you filter through those go very quickly and are pretty much allocated from year to year to the same groups. So there is some basis on how to rent the louder days. You just have to, I guess, almost be part of a factory or an established team test or a series test to be able to have those days.
Okay. So on to the Monterey Peninsula as a whole. Just recently, just a couple of days ago, there was an article in the Monterey County Herald, and it's been discussing some of the problems that we've been hearing about with the local hotels and some of the other businesses that have been accused, you know, unfairly or not, of price gouging and unfair business practices and things like that. Is there any sort of comments on that that you'd like to make?
Well, we obviously are very interested in how our hotels are doing business, and I don't think anyone will argue that a weekend such as the Red Bull U.S. Grand Prix is going to command higher prices than a random January weekend on anywhere you're at, let alone on the Monterey Peninsula. So we've really got two factors at work. I think we're okay. I don't think anyone will argue that prices are higher at peak times than not. That's just good business sense on the hotels. And then two, that they're allowed to charge higher prices. And the problems were really isolated to just a handful of events, or a handful of hotels. And what we wanted to do was try to explain to the hotels that while you may be able to raise your prices, the one that may work for you in the short term, that in the long term, people are going to stop coming to this event or rather stop staying in their hotels, in turn stop coming to the event, which in turn, if people don't come, makes the event go away, which of course means no one's staying in their hotels on that weekend. So we want to make them aware of the problem. And Joe Campbell, our CEO, has really had a large hand in stating the case. She was quoted through that article a couple of times. And we just want to, our first step really here is to make them aware. Now, that is entirely different from a couple of situations that arose that I don't know the details on, again, where there were actually illegal activities which is completely different. Canceling hotel room rates and things of that sort. Unfortunately, or fortunately, being in a capitalist society, supply and demand kind of dictates the price, and they're allowed to raise the price as high as someone's willing to pay it. Now, it may not be fair, and we're trying to make them aware of the effects of that, but what's not legal are people who received one rate, for instance, only to have that canceled and rebooked at a higher rate. Hotels are not allowed to do that, nor are they allowed to overbook hotel rooms, much like an airline does. Airlines have a special consideration to be able to overbook and then drop passengers, and I'm not sure why they get that. That's a different conversation.
Yeah.
but hotels are not allowed to do that, and I guess the point I'm getting to is twofold. One, that we are trying to address the hotel situation with the handful of hotels that are a major problem here on the peninsula. And two, if anyone's listening and had those problems, they should contact the Monterey Convention and Visitors Bureau and possibly the county attorney's office, because those things aren't allowed, and they should make them aware of that problem as it happens. You know, we certainly get those calls and those questions and those comments, but again, that's not something that we can control as much as we'd like to. So make sure you report it to someone who can directly affect the problem if you've got that issue. And it doesn't hurt to drop a note. Again, be polite, because these people aren't the ones causing the problems, but it doesn't hurt to drop a note to the Convention and Visitors Bureau in town and just say, hey, you know, we've got a real problem with the way this hotel is doing business, and if they get enough complaints, they'll look into it and may drop them from their membership. They're in their rights to do that. So there's two points there. One, that we're trying to address it, and two, if you do have a problem, let somebody know. Don't just stew over it, because that doesn't solve anything.
Talking about hotels and places for people to stay, if someone's, you know, wants to come to the races and maybe they don't want to do the hotel thing for whatever reason, you guys still have camping spots available there, right?
We do. We unfortunately are sold out of all the reserve spaces here. The spaces with hookups and the preferred camping spaces here. Everybody who had one of those last year was given the opportunity to renew. And about 99% of them did. So those are gone, unfortunately. But we do have other camping spots available, including the Toro Park camping, where a lot of people stayed last year. So a lot of those are still available and ready for sale.
Okay. And I, you know, like I said, I stayed in the Archery Campground last year, which is your overflow camping, and it's pretty much, you know, a large grassy area. And I mean, for me, that's fine. I've camped in much worse situations.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we term that, you know, unimproved camping. And it was sort of neat for me to see, you know, I've been to a number of European Grand Prix, and you just see hills, you know, the hills flowing off into the distance covered with tents and camping. And we actually had that here at Moss Raceway Laguna Seca. It was pretty neat to see.
Right. I believe in Europe they call it improved camping because it has grass, right?
Definitely.
one problem, though, that I did find last year was the lack of potable water on site. Is that going to be addressed this year?
Yes, it is. That's you know, two things, water and toilets. Those are two of our big issues. So, we followed the ratio of person per toilet last year, but still it wasn't enough, and we're going to make sure that not only do we have a greater number, but a proper distribution throughout the facility, and again, more water as well.
All righty, great. Well, gentlemen, I thank you very much for your time here on the phone. It's been really interesting. I think it's going to be really informative for our listeners. And about 55% of the audience is based in the U.S., about 45% international. And I'm sure that a whole bunch from both the U.S. and our international listeners are going to be there, because it is a signature event. It's an excellent track and a good place to go see a GP, along with a lot of the attractions that California has to people that are coming on a vacation, and they combine it with other vacations. So we definitely hope to, you know, as many MotoGPOD contingent as we can get out there at the U.S. Grand Prix in July. And I, again, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thanks for
it.
Okay, that's going to do it for today. I hope you liked the show. There's more good stuff coming up in future shows, so keep on listening. And as always, if you want to send an email with comments or suggestions or whatever, the address is motogpod@motogpod.com. Look forward to hearing from you. And until next Friday, ride safe and enjoy the races. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.